to the Inland Africa podcast. My name is Claire Falkvane, and today we are going to be talking about funding Africa's energy transition. I am joined today by Gian Alexander Hua, CEO of NG Energy Access, Ashish Kumar, Head of Innovation from the Shell Foundation, Mandy Rambaros, GM, Just Energy Transition Office, ESCOM, Ashish Khanna, Practice Manager for West and Central Africa from the World Bank, and Emeka Wosu, who is the Business Development Director for Africa from Longi Solar. I'd like to start the discussion off by asking if each one of you could perhaps give me some idea of what the energy transition means for either you personally or for your organization more generally. Mandy, perhaps you could start us off by speaking about it from an ESCOM perspective.
So from an ESCOM perspective, what the just energy transition means for us is transitioning towards a lower carbon, socially inclusive future that looks at not just reducing our carbon emissions and decarbonizing the grid, but it looks at also at how can we increase sustainable jobs in the country. So it's that full value chain where we look at the just and the transition as equally important, and how do we implement strategies, plans, activities, business models to actually meet both those imperatives.
And Gignon, maybe you could give us an idea from the NG perspective, what does the energy transition mean?
Yes, sure. First of all, if I start by talking about NG, NG has always been for long within the energy transition, let's say, mindset, and it's really core to our group. Very recently, NG has announced that it will continue to fight climate change and to accelerate decarbonization. NG has said that the full group for all direct and indirect emissions will reach net zero carbon by 2045. Now, if I talk about my entity, so NG Energy Access, it's embedded in our mission. Our mission is to deliver life-changing, affordable, reliable, and sustainable energy solution with an exceptional customer experience. So we really see in the energy transition the accelerator or the catalyzer of access to energy. In order, as a purpose, to improve the quality of life and economic potential in grid-deficient communities. So we are focusing on sub-Saharan Africa countries and the rural areas in order to provide access to electricity in a very sustainable manner to push any polluting solution. When I mean push, push back, or eliminate would be even better. So I'm representing NG in a dedicated entity, which is called NG Energy Access. And our mission is to provide energy to the rural areas in sub-Saharan Africa. So for us, rural electrification means two different, let's say, activities. The first one is what is called solar home system. So it's individual product that we provide to the people without access to electricity on an individual basis, and also mini grid. Mini grid is a small generation capacity to which we connect neighboring houses or productive usages in order to also give access to electricity to a rural area.
Fantastic. Thanks very much. Ashish Kumar, could you perhaps from the Shell Foundation share how your organization sort of defines the energy transition?
At Shell Foundation, we have been working for the last couple of decades in the area of energy access, which we believe is fundamentally linked to energy transition. Essentially, our current research shows that achieving energy access by 2030, or that is SDG 7, will provide an opportunity to abate over 630 million tons of carbon. And we can't imagine a world where we are talking energy transition, which doesn't have the goals of energy access included. We believe that the energy transition should be green and inclusive. And that's where we have been playing a critical role in creating market-based solutions over the last 15, 20 years. And we want to mobilize that the need for financing further to achieve SDG 7, where some of the climate finance instruments that we have will play a critical role.
Ashish Khanna, perhaps you could share the World Bank's perspective with us as well, please.
So thanks a lot. Wonderful to be here. As you know, World Bank is working on all countries of Africa. For us, energy access and clean energy transition go completely hand in hand. There are about 600 million people in sub-Saharan Africa who do not have energy access. And those who have energy access have actually access to power cuts because the average consumption is less than 5% of an OECD average. 68% of hospitals and 75% of schools do not have energy access. And economic losses in most countries are up to 4% of their GDP just due to energy sector, where power has been highlighted as one of the top three indicators in doing business problems in each of the countries. What is worst because of this competitiveness is that the unit cost of electricity in sub-Saharan Africa is almost double that in anywhere else in the world, mostly OECD. That creates a big challenge, not only in terms of expanding energy access, but also competitiveness of all industries. So for us, the clean energy transition has two big pillars. One, expanding energy access, which stands at only 50% today. How we can actually achieve universal access by 2030 with targets of at least 65% in the next 4 or 5 years. And secondly, using the NDCs of the countries to expand renewable energy as one of the most important ways in the interim for expansion of energy. But what I'll come later is how the greatest impediment is actually on sector reforms in terms of getting clean energy transition. I'll be happy to talk later on that. Thank you.
Ashish Khanna, thank you very much. It's interesting to see that for both the World Bank and for energy access, so much of that transition is centered around providing access to electricity and not just a transition from a particular type of technology to another. You know, the assumption is that the transition is purely technical. So it's a really, really, I think, valid point to make that the transition is more than just the technology that is fostering it. So Emeka, last but certainly not least, as the supplier and the manufacturer of PV solar panels and systems.
Certainly. Thank you, Claire. Thank you for the invitation. And it's good to be with Enlit once again. So yeah, from an OEM perspective, as you know, LONGi is a leading manufacturer of monopack models and also a huge supplier of the wafers as well. So LONGi has about 40% of the global market share of the wafers. From our perspective, similar to Ashish's point as well, we see both as the same. Both are critical to us, access and transition, particularly in the continent of Africa. In most African markets, it's not just about the transition or growing the installed capacity in each country, but also to reaching the unserved areas. So when you factor in the issues around most of the markets, which I believe we'll talk about a little bit later, in terms of infrastructure, transmission network, and et cetera, we see as a module supplier critical role to play in enabling mini-grid developers as well in completing or making those mini-grid projects bankable.
Emeka, thank you very much. The energy transition for Africa is looking obviously very different to that in parts of the world, such as Europe or the United States. And I'm looking forward to us having a conversation about how this is going to play out. So, as you know, I think if I may, NG Energy Access has recently launched the Access to Energy Business in Africa. And this predominantly focuses on the integration of solar home systems, companies such as Phoenix International, NG Mobile, and NG Power Corner. So what I wanted to find out from you is, what are the methods that you are using in order to approach the funding? Because this is always a challenging part of any discussion. And what are the DFI or concessions or government support that you are able to bring to the table?
So the question is very valid, and it's definitely one of the part of the formula that we need to crack. Funding is crucial. And I can say that we cannot rely on one single source of funding. It must be blended sources of funding in order to make our projects bankable and also viable. So as you just mentioned, we do attract DFIs that brings to the market concessional fundings or grants, or let's say impact investors. Thanks to that, we have also access to commercial financing, supported, of course, by commercial banks. If I go a little bit more into details and starting by the mini grid, we really see that DFIs and donors should be working together with authorities to de-risk the project. By de-risking the project, this will become more attractive to private commercial investors. And when we launch project in sub-Saharan Africa, we are also partnering with local companies in order to work together and to scale up faster. So yes, for Minigrid, we need both impact capital, but also commercial capital in order to reach the amount of fundings that are required to make the project viable for private equity investors. Minigrid is definitely an infrastructure business. On the SHS angle, which is a retail business, so we are selling to individuals mainly, a little bit to B2B as well. Just on top of what I said, so these blended sources of financing, we think that a good way to trigger more private investment on debt side would be to see partnership of DFIs and impact investors with local banks, because then it would trigger higher volumes in local currency financing, which is also quite important to us. And the second part, we have a kind of large portfolio of customer already in sub-Saharan Africa. We are impacting 5 million of lives as of today. And so we see in a kind of beneficial way that investment into loan portfolio of SHS customers would be on the radar screen of international debt investors. So that's the way we look at funding in the two aspects and also globally.
Ash Kumar, I'm going to focus on you for a second. And as head of innovation for the Shell Foundation, you worked with a couple of other partners on a new report which came out, and that was the Green Energy Future for Africa. According to the report, there is a $200 billion climate investment market opportunity for climate-first investors. So my question to you is, what are the innovative mechanisms that the Shell Foundation is working on or seeing on the horizon that specifically address energy transition needs in this context?
Right. So the point around energy transition being inclusive and green that we just covered, we believe it requires a low carbon scenario to be pursued. And that low carbon scenario in turn requires backing of growing distributed renewables, as well as tackling unreliable grids and supporting clean cooking solutions. While this sounds ambitious, we are grounded in realism as well. And there are at least three innovative mechanisms that I can cite here, which we feel would play a critical role. First is this UN-backed Universal Electrification Facility, which is fundamentally a results-based financing subsidy program, which we have also led the co-design of over the last few years. And it is seen as, it was created fundamentally as a grassroots effort to move away from the short-term subsidy program mindset and provide the mini-grid developers an ongoing and consistently growing subsidy facility, which they can tap into and not having to wait for the short-term subsidy programs to, you know, stop and start and stop start over the period of time. This has the potential to also improve the commercial viability of the sector if you have, you know, a subsidy program to tap into. In terms of execution, this facility itself, the wave one, we are calling, or phase one, we already have programs in mind for Madagascar, Sierra Leone, and Benin. with support from GIZ and Rockefeller Foundation as well, and where we are targeting over 13,000 mini-grid connections in this current phase. Going forward, in the subsequent waves of this facility, we are aiming for almost half a billion of subsidies to be mobilized in the upcoming years, enabling to total connections of over 6 million for the beneficiaries in the target market. The second innovative mechanism that I'd like to highlight is in the area of impact monetization for in climate finance. You see, in the climate finance space, one of the most popular market instrument that is out there is called carbon credits. However, there's another instrument which is growing in its role, is called RECs, or Renewable Energy Certificates. Now, one REC fundamentally stands for 1 megawatt hour of renewable energy produced. Unlike carbon credits, where one carbon credit stands for 1 megaton of one ton of CO2 reduced. This REC market is growing, has been growing substantially in North America and Europe, especially where it is used for renewable energy procurement by global corporates. While we are happy with the progress that the market is making, we see an opportunity for bringing this REC market to our context of distributed renewables in Africa and similar regions. And towards that, we fundamentally have a vision to create a new instrument called DREC, or distributed REC, which could enable the finance flows in the REC market to be tapped into for the distributed renewables in many grid and solar system markets in Africa. Towards this, we have already created a programmatic initiative, and we are working on the design of the instrument. Then we are also mobilized some significant funding for grant support, and the goal is to launch concrete pilots, which we are in the final stages of, and tap into the needs and motivations of global corporates or climate pledges made by a number of leading institutions, and see how they can achieve their scope 2 and scope 3 emission goals, while at the same time addressing the livelihood impact goals in the emerging markets. There has been some precedent of this instrument applied, and we are planning to take it to the next level in terms of market adoption. And finally, but not the least of those, is innovative mechanisms around the blended finance structures that we have been seeing being adopted consistently over a period of time. By blended finance, we mean how we can create a tiered structure of risk return profile for different types of concessional or commercial investors to come in towards financing of distributed renewables. One example that I can give from our current portfolio is something called EEGF, Energy Entrepreneurs Growth Fund, which is managed by fund manager Triple Jump, where we, and with the support from FMO, did a first close. And what we are observing in the sector is to really achieve the goal of SDG 7 and the kind of scale of financing needed, this role of blended finance will, and blended structures like these will only growing to increase, especially to tap into more commercial and institutional investor bases hitherto but not been tapped into. And they can come at the senior and super senior levels in these blended structures ideally. So I believe those three concrete innovative mechanisms, there are many other that could be possible, but these three we will continue to back and see the market uptake of in the coming time.
And Mandy, perhaps I could then direct a question to you, and that is the Just Energy Transition Office is housed within the ESCOM's offices. What is your work primarily focused on? And does it just relate to the decarbonization of South Africa's national electricity system, or does it extend to what happens beyond that, such as in the coal mines and other attendant industries? And secondary to that, is where will the money come from for your Just Energy Transition Office to do the important work that it needs to do?
Right. So, Claire, I think, you know, given the nature of the work we do as ESCOM in general and the reach we have along the supply chain, both upstream and downstream, anything we do actually does have quite an impact on our suppliers, on our customers, and on attendant industries. So when we talk about the transition, yes, we are talking about how do we transition the electricity grid from higher carbon emitting technologies to lower carbon, cleaner, greener technologies. Absolutely has an impact on the supply chain, on the coal mining industry, on a number of industries that are linked to our electricity supply chain. So when we talk about our Just Energy Transition strategy, one of the things we highlight is the importance of collaboration and the importance of looking at this question from a national perspective. So yes, we are focusing on modeling work within ESCOM that looks at net zero pathways, that looks at what capacities we would need from a technology perspective, from electricity supply perspective. But then at the same time, as part of our strategies, we're ensuring collaboration with the likes of the Minerals Council, with other industries or other mining companies to understand what would be the impact on them and to look at working together on local manufacturing capability and job creation capability along that supply chain. We've also done some very deep socioeconomic studies to understand the impact of shutting down a coal plant. And so we've done these studies for Komati, Grootvlei, and Hendrina, three of our power stations that will be shut down very soon. And we've looked at the impact not just on the Eskom power station, but the community around the power station, the impact on GDP, the impact on jobs, and the impact on that local municipality, so Diphala Seng, Steve Tshwete municipalities, on in Mpumalanga and in South Africa. So understanding that full impact is extremely important for us. And then more importantly, I'd say, is the so what question. What do you do with all of this information you have in terms of the impact? And so that is where we're collaborating with others to understand how can we mitigate the negative impact of plant shutdown, ensuring that when we repower with renewables and other lower carbon technologies, that we're creating local manufacture capability and creating jobs along that supply chain. So where does the money come from? In terms of the JET office itself, obviously we work in ESCOM, so it's within the ESCOM structure in terms of manpower and things. But in terms of the actual projects and the actual work that we want to implement, we are talking to funders almost on a daily basis to look at grant funding for a lot of the studies that we want to get done. So these socioeconomic impact studies I'm talking about, to understand what the impact will be on ESCOM and on the communities around them. And I think there's a lot of interest. So we've got some really good funders on board that have agreed to do some grant funding around the socioeconomic studies. But I think the biggest question is funding for the actual repowering, for putting those renewables on the ground. And there as well, we have lots of interest from financiers, from the development finance institutions, the DFIs, and multilateral banks. It is concessional loans that we're talking about, and no matter how highly concessional your loan is, if you're highly indebted, any more debt obviously has a negative impact. So we're also talking then, making sure that we're engaging with government, with the various government role players to understand what the impact will be from a financial perspective on ESCOM, on the country, and how we can afford this plan. So I must say there's been lots of positive discussions, and we're now just talking about how we take that forward and actually get a project on the ground. We're very keen to get the repowering of Komati done and off the ground as soon as possible, as we think that'll be a proof of concept for this whole process of a just energy transition going forward. Thanks, Claire.
Mr. Ashish Khanna, what measures is the World Bank putting in place with regards to the transition? First of all, who's going to pay, particularly when it comes to things like stranded assets and helping to create new greener energy assets? And if you are wanting to attract private sector capital, what are the impediments to attracting that? I realize lots of questions, but perhaps you could give it a go.
Thanks, Claire, again. I think the speakers have given a very good sense of the challenges and the opportunities for transformation using off-grid applications and productive uses But if you allow, let me step back and give you a big picture, which I have to admit is very humbling, that our detailed assessment on energy access financing needs for universal access are $200 billion for entire sub-Saharan Africa till 2030. That implies $20 billion annually. Now, we believe under post-COVID scenario, where energy access has become so central, like having this virtual conference would have been impossible, we have expanded our portfolio by 50%, even under a virtual environment. But even after expanding it by 50%, we are at $3 billion. So we have to first admit the challenge is huge, and it's going to take everyone pulling together. Now, what are the elements by which this financing can come in? And I have to say that based on my extensive experience in Asia, and Middle East, North Africa, and a little bit other continents over the last 16 years, what private sector wants on the first is really a good, transparent, and credible policy frame. So the governments need to have a credible policy framework that's based on least cost generation plan, as much of transparency mechanisms like the least cost generation plan backed by competitive bidding. We are still not seeing that a lot of African countries are doing solar parks based on a lot of competitive bidding by inviting large grid connected solar plants. So I would say that that part of an enabling framework is extremely critical. We do have elements of that in some countries, but still that's a long way to go. The second, and I would say this as probably the most important issue, what is the risk of credit for the off-taker? And unfortunately, we have utilities, less than 30% of them are really able to meet their cash operating costs. So unless you really need private sector to come in big way in these countries for generation projects, because mind you, the $200 billion was without the large-scale generation that is still needed. That's just on energy access. So if you really need a lot of private sector investments on part energy access, but also large generation, they really need creditworthy off-takers, because who's going to guarantee their payment security mechanisms? The third is really on regional trade and regional learning. There are lots of countries which are unfortunately too small to be having a very competitive energy sector of their own. So the South African power pool and the West African power pool have already demonstrated the power of establishing regional transmission interconnections that allow for regional optimization of the least cost and markets for trade really developed. I would say the East African power pool is next in line, and unfortunately the Central African power pool is the least. And finally, my last point in terms of what is the key enabler are some of the enabling framework elements are A, having a very clear national electrification strategy that is based on use of geospatial tools, but also a very clear framework which parts are likely to be grid connected and which parts are likely to be off-grid connected, including mini grids. Because any private sector would like to have certainty of what is going to happen if grid tomorrow reaches their area of operation as well. The other element of that is the policy and regulatory certainty of what is going to happen to the tariffs in the mini grid areas. Are they going to be regulated? Are they not going to be regulated? So I would say the summary of this is that a good planning that's based on least cost generation and competitive bidding, sector reforms on utility financial viability, having the regional trade and regional interconnections, and finally, this enabling framework of national electrification strategy plans and the regulations on the off-grid. They are essential elements for bringing in. I can talk, if you want to listen, on how World Bank is using different instruments to enable all of this, but maybe if you like me to go right now, or I can come in later on that.
I think if you wouldn't mind, perhaps just giving us a little bit of context. I mean, I think one of the biggest challenges is that So often countries don't know where to access different types of funding or what instruments are actually available. So yeah, if you wouldn't mind, I'd be really grateful.
Yeah, so you know what we have realized is because the challenge is so huge and each country's context, I must admit, will also be very different. We need a plethora of instruments from the World Bank side, some that are directed to making sure the policy and the regulatory framework is appropriate. We have an instrument called Development Policy Financing that is a kind of a credit or a grant directly to the budget on having the right policy frameworks. We are now expanding to have a regional framework to get regional trade also going in the West African power. So that's an instrument that's largely with a, given to the governments, but that is to make sure the policy and the regulatory framework is appropriate for both trade, financial viability, transparency, structured payments being made for all power being purchased. The second is really on results based, because I think Africa, like a lot of places, has seen a lot of policy, but not effective implementation. So it's time that when you make a policy, whether on energy access, in terms of number of connections, in terms of putting in a system of like standardized procurement for health centers, standardized procurement, or maybe an innovation like results-based financing of giving an upfront capital subsidy for certain mini grids and then asking for the private sector to come in, getting those things implemented lead to the results funding being released, not beforehand. These instruments are also being used for getting the financial viability of the utility also, making sure the tariffs are set more properly, making sure the efficiency improvement, whether because the losses are still too high and services get better. And then, of course, there are financial intermediation where the financial institutions can leverage a lot of private financing to support a lot of, you know, companies that we have in the panel today in how they're going to scale up. You know, I personally believe the way the solar PV players, which 10, 15 years back when, you know, I expected them to become billion-dollar companies, I personally believe a lot of these players who can do a lot of innovative business models will need the debt and equity support to really expand. So I would say that's also the kind of financial intermediation support we give in addition to direct investments financing. Our final product is guarantees that we give very selectively when the reform framework is appropriate, but right now the private sector needs additional support on payment security. So on a case-by-case basis, we do for countries do give some kind of a payment security credit risk or a payment security guarantee as well.
If I may bounce back, if you allow
please,
me.
Please.
I really like what you said. It's also a view that we share, and just maybe to give you the view we have on the result-based finance. To us, the result-based finance approach involves three key principles that really help the business. The first one is that the payment is only made if you reach results. So it means that you have an agreement on a tangible outcome that you need to achieve to get the finance. The recipient of this result-based financing can be proactive to achieve this result faster. And achieving a result faster is in any case a positive outcome, a positive output for the consumer, for the country. And lastly, which I think is also very important, is that there is an independent verification of the results, which bring a certain transparency in the process. So as selling SHS and creating mini grid, we really support this kind of initiative, because if it's replicated, it means that it's a simple process. The process being simple, then you can do it multiple times and you don't have to review changing terms and conditions, etc. It's measurable. So what we all want is to do something which impacts. It's replicable. You could do it in a country and do exactly the same in another one. And it's timely, because you receive the money when you need it, and depending on the result that you provide. On top of that, as I said, the last step being the transparency, it provides to a mechanism a certain consistency as well, which makes for investors a better visibility on project profitability, etc. So, which makes in the end scalable project bankable.
Thank you so much. I think there's definitely seems to be a big move toward performance-based contracting of some sort in the construction industry, in the road sector. So it's good to see that this is something that is filtering down into the energy sector as well. I am going to ask you gentlemen, and you of course as well, Mandy, what is the message that you would like to leave with our audience? Mandy, if I could ask you just for your closing remarks.
I think it's very difficult to look at change and think of the positives, especially when you're very used to the old way of doing things. So I think the biggest takeaway is to just open up our minds to this transition pathway. Look at what's happened in other countries and how it has positively impacted so many countries. And for me, one of the most positive things about a number of the discussions that we've been having with international governments, with funders, is that they are extremely keen to see South Africa do well. They're extremely keen for South Africa to be the flagship for the way a just energy transition should unfold. If you look at experience in the UK, in Northern England, for example, it's an example of how not to do the transition. You know, there's a lot of communities there that are still struggling. And I think South Africa can be the flagship. So I think we need to regain our place on that throne of being a country of change, a country of innovation, and just take hold of the opportunity that's in front of us.
And Ashish Kumar, maybe you could share yours with us.
Right. So I'd like to build here on what Mr. Ashish Khanna had said in terms of better coordination at the policy and the government, public sector level for the energy access sector. That made me reflect on some of the initiatives that we are doing exactly towards that, again, in the realm of subsidy, but we think those are fundamental towards achieving universal energy access. There's a recent initiative towards what we call demand side subsidies, which is more like a coordinated effort, working potentially with the likes of World Bank, towards creating what we are calling applied prototyping laboratory, which will enable more like universal programs towards creating subsidy like mechanisms. For especially targeting the lowest income customers in the energy access space. Within that, I believe there are like different private sector players in energy access who have their at the enterprise level programs with the government, but it needs to be mobilized at a much larger scale. And that's where some of the work from the likes of World Bank on having the government and public sector totally engaged in creating a pool of capital in a much more coordinated and programmatic manner would really help the private sector here in tackling some of those energy access growth challenges.
And Julien, perhaps you could give us your final message to the audience.
Yes, sure. Maybe three of them. The first one, as we discussed, off-grid technology are needed really to close the access to energy gap for the next decades in Africa. That's one. If we take this as a starting point, both government and public utilities can't address the shortage of electricity by their own or on their own. There is a need for an intertwined collaboration, planning, but also development, implementation, and operation in the sector in order to allow private sector to play also a role in the access to energy through, for instance, solar home system, renewable mini-grid, decentralized solution. And at the latest, and we discuss about that, access to long-term financing at affordable rates, and I'm maybe focusing on that, affordable rates, can bring off-grid products and services within the reach of millions, and when I say millions, it's hundreds of millions of non-connected users in Africa.
Thank you very much. Emeka?
It's estimated that Africa will see about 70 gigawatts of solar installations within the next 10 years. That is doable. That is possible. What I would like, you know, the discussions we've had here today is if in the next couple of years we'll see some of the implementation of key factors across the industry from a country level and from an industry level, so that we'll give confidence to some of the markets or the countries in Africa to get cheaper financing and enable projects on the continent. From a Longi perspective, we like to see this as, think of the project as a 25-30-year marriage. I know I don't want to put a deadline to your marriage, but it is a partnership that it's very important. So we encourage, because people see models as a commodity, right? But when we constitute 40 to 50% of the cost of your project, we are more than that, right? We are critical to the success of the project. So we want to partner with our partners, look more deeply with and look at third-party reports on the components that you're using, right? And do your due diligence properly, okay, in selection of your partners. Who will be there in the next couple of years and to back their warranty? So I just hope that in the next couple of years, we'll see a more access and a more viable, you know, Africa. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you very much. And last but certainly not least, Ashish Khanna, perhaps you could give us the final word.
So thanks. First of all, a big thanks to the NLIT team for this opportunity. You know, I have been 2 years in Africa Energy after spending maybe more than 1.5 decades in other continents. I just feel the what is now fairly well known in this subcontinent. It's all about how. And in terms of how, I really hope the post-COVID economic recovery, which does require, as we are seeing country after country everywhere in the world talking about green and resilient infrastructure, we can use this opportunity to really usher in a very large-scale transformation of the sector that I have to confess has to start with the financial viability of the utility. You will not be able to get the investments that are needed to meet the energy access and growth requirements until and unless the utilities have viable tariffs, they are run efficiently. The point that Emeka talked about, managerial capacity, that's extremely important. The second, if you want to get financing, which is the heart of this today's topic, I would say the most important thing is coordination. Coordination at the country level, because country is where the action is going to be at every context, but coordination between donors, coordination between government and private sector, coordination between the regulator and the citizens, because until unless the frameworks of a least cost plan that are competitively managed, a lot of innovation to use the technology for getting efficiency, accountability, making sure you know, all the elements of different parts are put together, it's going to be very difficult. The challenge is huge, but the timing is right. And I think I have to say one last thing. Compared to a lot of countries outside I have worked, I find the openness to try new things and to involve private sector is very high in Africa compared to a lot of, you know, countries outside. So I really am really hoping for a big call of action and a lot of innovation going forward to solve these financing challenges. Thank you.
On behalf of the team here at Inlet Africa, I'd like to thank today's experts for sharing their valuable insights with us. I would also like to remind you that a recording of the webinar session of this podcast, which is slightly longer and contains a bit more information, is available along with all the other sessions from Inlet Africa. Thank you for joining us on this Inlet Africa podcast. This episode is brought to you in partnership with ESI Africa. For more podcasts, visit our websites or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. Be sure to tune in again soon for more conversations and insights into the things that really matter to Africa's energy industry. Until next time, I'm Claire Falkvane, and you've been listening to the Inland Africa Podcast.